Now we're joined by our favorite doctor, one of my BFFs in the world. He's a professor of pediatrics and director of the Center for Health Policy and Professionalism Research at Indiana University. He's the author of three books. His newest, all of which debunk medical myths, is about sex myths called Don't Put That In There and 69 Other Sex Myths Debunked. If it's not in your bathroom, you're missing out on a great conversation starter as well as the other two books. He is a contributor to the New York Times, the Upshot section. He has videos every week that get posted on YouTube, produced by John Green. Yes, that John Green, the best-selling author and the guy who's got the movie out and so on and so forth, YouTube star. And he's on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll. And, of course, you can read his blog. He blogs at The Incidental Economist. And tons to talk about with him today. Dr. Aaron Carroll joining us right now. Follow him on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll. That's how we pay him. If you're not following him, you're really missing out. Hello, friend.
How are you?
Tons to talk about with you, as always. I think it's really interesting. Well, let's start with the sun. The Surgeon General yesterday came out and warned about sunbathing and tanning. He basically said, stop tanning. You've got a video at Healthcare Triage on YouTube about sunscreen and that it works. So let's talk about how dangerous bathing in the sun is. And what sunscreen works and what the limits are, because there's a lot of myths and confusion about that, right? And why did I just buy, why did I just fall for the ad? I think it's Coppertone, is now selling a sunscreen specifically for the bald white man.
Okay.
And I bought it.
No,
like
you're
it's
lying.
Any different than, yeah,
that
I did.
True?
The ad worked on me, and it can't be any different than any other sunscreen.
What is it, SPF like 1,000? What is it?
It's SPF Pete Dominic.
Oh, SPF zero. Anyway, so come on. It's like at this point, it's hard to even to. I have a hard time imagining people don't know this, but UV rays are bad for your skin. They
vitamin D. What are you talking about? They're good. It's
okay,
good for you.
Link between vitamin D and this. Yeah, it's like you need some light to get vitamin D, but there's a big difference between, like, you know, normal activities and the amount of exposure that you'll get to just walking around and be in the world. To get the light you need for vitamin, there's like no real good study that shows that like people who don't bathe in the sun are vitamin D deficient. It's just not there. And there's lots of these like hypotheses about how like, you know, vitamin D and that's the link to cancer and everything else. But the link is no stronger than it is between like, you know, agave being the new thing that's going to make your life live 10 longer, or that antioxidants, you know, 20 years ago were going to be the things that, you know, solved all our problems and everything else. There's no good science linking one end all the way to the other. It's just theory and supposition. What we do know is that UV rays cause your skin to age and look terrible. There's no question about that. They cause it to sag and to wrinkle and to do all that, and they cause increased rates of melanoma. And there's good documentation of that. And we're not talking about, you know, small, absolute risk increases. These are big, big risk increases that's absolutely shown. And using sunblock and staying out of the sun has been shown even in randomized controlled trials to reduce that risk.
And what – okay, so what about sun? I mean, well, first of all, I mean – at what point does tanning, like a tanning bed, become dangerous?
Like using it at all, I would say. Like there's just no, I mean, come on, if you probably use it a couple times in your life, you're not going to have a problem. I mean, I'm not, you know, it's not going to be like all of a sudden you got to be panicking every day.
Like I only go to the tanning before a big audition for a movie, which happened once.
Yeah, then you're probably fine. In fact, you are fine. I won't even say probably. I won't qualify it. It's like, of course, everything in moderation is likely fine. It's just one of those things that just becomes habit-forming, and why engage in it at all? It's just not necessary. And again, I always sort of say, you got to weigh the risks and the benefits. And in this case, I just can't see the benefit. So any risk at all seems quite harmful. But there's no question that, you know, using this stuff all the time and using it, you know, one and the other is not good for you, and it increases your risk of cancer. And there's tons of myths going around about, you know, oh, the sunscreen causes cancer. No proof of that at all. Or you use sunscreen and then you don't have vitamin D. No proof of that at all. The sunscreen that you put on is not protecting you 24/7. You are being exposed to the sun. You are likely getting plenty of sunlight. It's the idea that, you know, when you go out and spend all day at the beach with your shirt off, running around in the super bad sun, it's not good for you. It's not good for you. You should be using sunblock.
Sunblock, what kind?
To be honest, it really doesn't matter whether you use the organic and the inorganic kinds. When I talk about organic or inorganic, this is not like, I don't mean natural versus chemical. Organic means they're built out of carbon compounds. They are organic compounds in the strict chemical sense. Those types of sunscreens get absorbed into the skin, at which point they absorb sun's rays in the skin and sort of turn them into other, absorb them and put them out in different ways and make them less harmful. Inorganic sunscreens are the really thick ones that sort of sit on the skin and they're pure blockers. It's like zinc oxide. It doesn't matter what you use, they both work. They absolutely do. It doesn't matter which kind you use. There are some studies coming out of Europe that talk about that some sunscreens are more harmful than others. Those studies just haven't sort of reached a critical mass yet where people know about them. Again, as I always say, it's like we should be constantly watching research and seeing what's going on. But what exists right now overwhelmingly says sun exposure is really not good for you and that sunscreen absolutely works and is safe.
What level, though? There's different levels, there's kinds for the baby's skin and fair skin people. I mean, isn't there some, like, truth to, like, after 30 SPF, it doesn't matter?
Yes. Yeah, well, the question is, like, how much does it matter? See, everybody assumes that, like, 30 is twice as good as 15, and 60 is twice as good as 30, and 90 is going to be three times as good as 30.
If you're really white.
SPF 15, it gives you like 94%. What it is like it's a times protection. They're not relative to each other. They're all relative to something else. So SPF 15 is like 94% absorbs like or blocks 94% of the sun's UV rays. SPF 30 is like 96%. SPF 45 is like 97%. So as you get higher, you are getting incrementally less and less to the point where it's like the difference between SPF 30 and 90 is like less than 1% blockage. And that's meaningless. I mean, truly meaningless, because they sell the SPF 90, of course, in the tiniest tube, and it's the most expensive, so you're absolutely guaranteed to use too little of it. And if you use too little of it, then it's worthless. It's not helping at all. You're supposed to use a shockingly large amount of sunscreen, something like 1 ounce or, like a shot glass bowl. Every time you put it on, spread evenly over like the 9 different areas of your body. You're supposed to put it on like a half hour before you go out in the sun and then 20 minutes after you go out in the sun. And then you're supposed to reapply it every time you vigorously sweat or you are wet or you're active. In other words, basically all day at the sun. So if you really follow the recommendations, you should be using a shockingly large amount of sunscreen to get that 94% protection that SPF 15 would give you. You are far better off likely buying SPF 15 or 30 by the tub and applying it liberally than to buy SPF 110 and use it sparingly. That's worthless.
Tub is funny.
If you find it by the tub, you should buy it by the tub.
Tub of sunscreen. Hey, can you go to the Costco and get me a tub of sunscreen? Why?
You should also be getting the like barrel of generic ibuprofen there as well. It's the same kind of thing.
You should get generic ibuprofen as opposed to Advil.
No, there was a great article I just saw recently that said like they surveyed doctors and pharmacists to see like whether they use generics or name brand drugs, and for like things like that, way more doctors are using generics because they of course recognize like why, what difference does it make? It's like it's generic ibuprofen. There's no magic to that. That ibuprofen, acetaminophen, these things have been around forever, and it's like the idea that people would spend huge amounts of money for name brand Advil, when you could buy like I always say, generic ibuprofen by the barrel at Costco for so much cheaper. That's always what we buy here.
They have a barrel of it.
They have a barrel of the vitamins. I mean, it comes in a.
I mean,
very
you're
low
saying
bottle.
Barrel, and I think of an oil drum. I mean,
it's not that.
Don't
big.
You mean
you can
tub
get
or bucket
get vitamins at Costco in a thing that almost qualifies as a barrel? It is shockingly
really
large. Oh my God, they're amazing! Yeah, ibuprofen comes. You can't get like one, but you'll get a bottle of ibuprofen. You'll be like, I could not possibly, because Advil bottles are so tiny. You get like 10, 20 pills in those. Ibuprofen bottles, man, they come in the hundreds. It's amazing.
Do you save a shit ton of money buying it that way?
Oh, with the medications, absolutely.
Do studies prove that you're going to take more if you have more?
No, I don't think that they do, but I don't know that.
Does marijuana affect the adolescent brain?
Well, it affects all brains. If it wasn't affecting the brain, why would anyone use it?
That's a good point. There is the argument, and we've talked about this before, but I got to mention it because, this study or studies that talk about the effect that marijuana has damaging the adolescent brain, we've talked about that. You talked about it on the Great Lieberman Live on Howard Stern Channel last week, which is an amazing and hilarious appearance of Dr. Aaron Carroll with... He was on with Tan Mom and Jeff the Drunk. It's so damn funny. You got to listen to it. But anyway, about this question, adolescent brain and marijuana, how many studies are there on that, and what do they show?
Very few. And most of the studies show that, like, you know, that people use the people or teens that use marijuana can have detectable changes in their brain after they use it. But again, I would say I don't know why anyone is surprised by that. If marijuana did not affect the brain, no one would use it. We expect that it affects the brain. What we really care about is if it affects the brain permanently in ways that are damaging or harmful. For that, we have no answer.
Okay, to be clear, we don't have an answer.
No,
so not, and disclaimer, not encouraging adolescents.
No one should take that. I said that adolescents should all go out and smoke marijuana, nor I'm not endorsing anything. I'm just saying that you know, to do a study that shows on PET scans you can detect changes in the brain or brain chemistry, you know, before and after marijuana use, if you didn't, I would expect the marijuana did not work. So that is the finding that everybody has had, and that's the finding everybody freaks out about. But even if you read interviews by the authors of the studies who did that, they say what I just said, which is that, this is only a first step. You need to see if these are permanent, if these are long-term, and if they actually have any kind of ramification in the long-term for, you know, outcomes that we care about in terms of cognition or memory or anything else. There should be no question that marijuana affects the brain. Any drug or substance which causes any kind of, you know, mental status change at all should, of course, affect the brain, including many drugs that we use for psychiatric purposes. They should affect the brain. That's why we're using them. The question is, you know, whether there's long-term harmful effects in outcomes that matter. On that measure, we don't really have a good answer.
Not sure if you saw this study, Dr. Aaron Carroll, or not, but I saw this morning, and it was just outrageous to me. But here it is at newser.com. You can find it under the health section there. Veggies more dangerous than beef, at least when it comes to carrying diseases. Bear with me here. Here's Matt Cantor at Newser. An apple a day keeps a doctor away, unless, of course, it's carrying a disease. Turns out that vegetables and fruits are actually worse than beef and pork when it comes to making people sick, reports Bloomberg, based on a CDC paper from last year. Experts looked at illnesses and hospitalizations from various kinds of foods between 1998 and 2008. Healthy stuff, including fruits and vegetables, accounted for some 46% of illnesses. Leafy vegetables were responsible for most illnesses, while dairy was responsible for most hospitalizations. Beef ranked sixth in number of illnesses caused, behind fruits and nuts and various vegetables. It ranked seventh in hospitalizations. Pork ranked even lower in both cases. But don't think the CDC has given you an excuse to opt for a burger over broccoli. Other factors, such as health benefits of consuming a diet high in fruits and vegetables, must also be considered, according to researchers. Cut through the bullshit for us on this.
Well, that's just simply a matter of it's just simply because we cook our meat. Nobody's eating raw meat. So even if the meat comes to you contaminated or diseased, as long as you heat it up to the proper temperature, you've killed all the bad stuff and you're going to be fine. We eat tons of fruits and vegetables raw, which means that they have to be washed properly and all the stuff has gotten off of it. So basically what you're seeing there is very likely that, you know, whatever contaminants existed on the beef are being killed by cooking. Whatever contaminants existed on vegetables and fruits are just not being washed properly. So it's a call to do so. That's really it. I mean, that's all that is. Plus, you know, once again, we're talking about relative risk versus absolute risk. So you are, you know, the relative risk of being hospitalized because of contamination from a vegetable is higher than meat, but still both are incredibly low. The risk of dying of heart disease someday because you've eaten a terribly unhealthy diet is much, much, much higher in terms of absolute risk, and no one's going to argue that eating a terrible diet consisting only of sort of fatty meat is likely worse for you in that case than eating a diet of fruits and vegetables. Having said that, you know, I love meat, and it's like I'm much more of a moderation and everything kind of guy. I'm not advocating one or the other, but, you know, certainly the take-home message from that article shouldn't be eat less fruits and vegetables and eat more meat. It should be wash your few fruits and vegetables carefully to make sure that you wash any contaminants off of them.
All right, here's a very anti-Semitic article I saw this morning. Two babies get herpes after Jewish circumcision ritual. Ancient ritual involves sucking blood from wound and spitting it aside. Yeeks.
First of all, that was in one of our books, man.
Oh, you debunked this?
No, that's real.
Oh, okay. Tell me about...
thing. There is some crazy, I mean, I shouldn't say crazy. There is some very religious sect of Judaism where after the circumcision, they stop the bleeding. I can't even believe this is real, but it is. They stop the bleeding with the mouth. And if you have a herpes lesion or herpes virus in your mouth, as you are stopping the bleeding, then it can be passed on to the baby, which could result in a case of genital herpes in a newborn. It's horrific in every sense of the word. I just can't wrap my head around it. You should understand.
Well, yeah, but you had it done to you. You're Jewish.
This is a very, very rare thing that some people do. It is not part of any kind of mainstream Judaism.
Your sons?
No, nothing. No, they have.
Yourself?
No.
Your father?
I don't know anyone who's ever had this. I've never even met anyone, as far as I know, who've had this. I've never actually met anyone who actually has seen this happen. But it evidently does in some.
How is that legal?
Because in this country, we allow a lot of stuff in the name of religion to be legal.
Yikes. Ugh.
I'm not even saying we shouldn't. I'm just saying that this one is one of those debatable ones. It's like, that's just weird.
You don't know one Jewish person that has
done this. Not a single. I mean, we're talking, I think it's very, very, very.
And religious. You know all of them, so.
Well, who doesn't? The
cabal is very active, I'm sure, in sharing this type of information. All right, I just mentioned that one.
Does not endorse that behavior.
It does not. The cabal does not endorse that behavior?
Absolutely not.
I read, okay, one or two more studies. This is always fun to do with Dr. Aaron Carroll, who is on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll. Why fist bumps trump handshakes?
Yeah.
True?
Because again, yeah. Well, I mean, again, this is the number one reason that sort of viruses get passed around and colds is because of human contact. I mean, truly, if we all engaged in proper hand washing, truly proper hand washing, like before we ate, before we touched our face, if we were much less, more careful about not touching our faces, not touching other spaces, that would reduce significantly the number of viral transmissible illnesses that get passed around. And of course, our hands are filthy. They just are. They're touching everything. And, you know, some people are really careful about washing their hands. Most people are not. And of course, if your hands are filthy, touching someone else's hands is the worst thing you could do, because now you're treating all whatever bad viruses you have, and then you move it around. So the idea that we would take this, it's the one part of our body that touches everything on the external world and is never really covered at all. And so the idea that we would use that to then touch other people, it absolutely is a vector for illness transmission. Having said that, you know, this is where I, like, you know, take everything with a grain of salt. It's like, it's not as if we've all been dying off because we've been shaking hands. If you look around, it is a risk factor and a vector for disease transmission, but not like a crazy dangerous one. The human race has survived for quite some time with handshaking, but it's also true that probably if we all switched to fist bumping, it would reduce the number of illnesses like that which are passed around.
Can we call it something other than fist bumping? Is there any way we could?
I don't know. I mean, why even do that? Why can't we wave? I mean, why do we have to
just walk right up to someone like 3 feet away and wave?
Yeah.
Hi, hello.
You know, just have a nice little nod. I'm okay with that too. Just
in Europe, though, you know, they do a lot of kissing when you meet. Certainly in Italy, where Val's family, my wife's family, is from, and I would imagine that's not any better than handshaking.
No, it's funny. It's like that. See, there's a great study I would love to do, but it's I can imagine I could make a case in both directions. I can make a case that you could think, okay, well, yeah, you're transmitting, but you know, mouths are shockingly. Mouths are dirty, but not usually in the same way that hands are. Because, you know, hands, you're constantly picking stuff from the outside world, especially if you do that air kiss thing, which the Europeans do, then there's really no risk at all.
How bad is Ebola? We're hearing a lot about it. It's terrible right now. It's happening in Liberia. An American doctor is very sick. One of the other doctors, African doctors or two, I think, have died. You have a 50% chance of dying if you get it. How hard is it to get? I know it's transmitted through bodily fluids.
It's hard.
But I mean...
Well, here's the thing. It's like one of those where it's first of all, I think it's even higher than 50%. I mean, it's a horrible, horrible, horrible disease. It's hard to get in the sense that because it is. See, the thing about a disease that, you know, that it's horrible in the sense that it kills so many people and it kills them quickly. But that's actually what keeps it contained. You know, the nightmare scenario would be a disease that could live in your body for a month before you got really sick and you could be transmitting it to everybody. This one is so bad that when you are sick, like, they can put you in a hospital, they can isolate you, and if they really wind up quarantining people well, you can let the disease sort of burn out. Of course, it kills almost everybody it comes in contact with, so it's terrible. So caring for people with it is incredibly dangerous because doctors and nurses and caregivers are exposed to bodily fluids. and they are therefore at significant risk. So the danger is in, you know, trying to keep people comfortable and quarantined and get them all together at the same time not exposing anyone else to risk. It's horrible. It is horrible. But, you know, the hope is always if they can contain it and if they can quarantine people properly, that it'll burn itself out and you know, the outbreak will stop.
We're talking to Dr. Aaron Carroll, who's also a contributor at the New York Times, the Upshot section of the New York Times, and as well as publishes videos almost every week on YouTube at Healthcare Triage. Really interesting videos describing different countries' healthcare systems that are important for folks to watch because there's been so many scare tactics used and mythology surrounding all of these other countries. I think one thing that's very interesting is when you published the one about Singapore, were you not contacted by, like, the president of Singapore or something? You've done name the countries, and then I'd love to hear the reaction of people, citizens, health policy experts, or leaders of those countries, if you've had any.
We've done the U.S. and Canada and France and the U.K. and Singapore and Germany. And the prime minister of Singapore actually retweeted and put the video up on Facebook, on his, like, Facebook page, and that said everybody should watch it. Well, that was a big kick for us because, you know, the fact that, like, the prime minister of the country is saying, like, hey, here's a great video about our country. That was pretty awesome. But fortunately, no other world leaders yet have acknowledged me.
Have you gotten any pushback from anybody from those countries saying not quite right?
No. So far, it's like we've been pretty good. I mean, once in a while you read the YouTube commenters and someone will get upset and be like, you know, you said that the copay for this was going to be 10 euros and it's really 12 euros. And it's like, all right, well, you know, maybe your one insurance plan had a different thing or maybe, you know, something else. But no, for the most part, the feedback on those videos has been unbelievably positive. Singapore was sort of vindicating in its own way because Singapore is a very complex healthcare system, and I've gotten into arguments on Twitter before with a number of, you know, health policy experts from all sides of the aisle who will, you know, say, like, well, you don't understand Singapore or this or that, or, you know, they misuse Singapore. I even say that in the video. People will take the one aspect of Singapore's, you know, thing that backs up what they want in healthcare reform, and they hold that up, but they ignore everything else that goes into it. And truthfully, Singapore's system has elements that both the left and the right in this country would love and hate. It was you know, nice that the prime minister was sort of like, yeah, here's something that describes the system very well, because, you know, at least it shows that we know what we're talking about.
At the New York Times, you published a piece titled, "Do You Own a Gun? In Florida, Doctors Can't Ask You That." Go ahead. What is this?
This is amazing. So, you know, if you have kids and you go to the pediatrician, you know, you will be asked many questions. They will be questions about, you know, do you have a pool? Do you watch them in the bathtub? Have you checked your hot water heater's temperature? Do you have chemicals to keep them out of reach? Do you have gates up? Do you let your kid use a walker? Do you use a car seat? Do you use a booster seat? Do you use a seatbelt? And one of the questions that we ask is there a gun in the home? And if you say yes, then we say, is the gun properly stored? You know, do you keep it away from ammunition? Do you have it locked up? Because these are things that are done, you know, to help prevent injury. And in Florida, like 2 years ago, someone, I guess, freaked out when a pediatrician asked them that question and then wound up going all the way to the NRA. And they passed a law which basically said it's illegal for a doctor to ask any questions about guns. And if they do, they can be censured, fined, or even lose their license. And that was overturned by the sort of, you know, the appeals court or the courts that I think initially who said that's a ridiculous First Amendment violation and the government should not be getting in between a doctor and a patient and their relationship, and that makes no sense. And then just this week or last week, the appeals court upheld it and said that the law is legal. And I wrote just a piece in the New York Times talking about the fact that, you know, you gotta own that, like, you know, homicide and suicide are huge contributors to pediatric morbidity and mortality. Like, they're the, you know, we're talking in the top 2, 3, 4 causes of death of children. And that guns, and, you know, guns result in, like, you know, more than 7,000 hospitalizations a year for children. Not all of them, you know, because of, like, some, you know, horrific crime spree or anything, or even a shooting in a school. Most of them are just accidents, or they are, you know, homicide or suicide or assaults or, you know, things that happen because kids have access to guns. And so pediatricians talk about this because basically they're just saying, yeah, you know, if you keep a gun, you ought to keep it locked up. If you have a gun, don't put the ammunition near it. You should keep them separate so that your child can't get into it. And we've asked these questions for decades. But legally now, the courts are saying, well, no. The people have the right not to be asked that question, which is a very strange First Amendment argument. I'd love to hear a lawyer talk about that. But, you know, we're supposed to ask sensitive questions. I begin by talking about the fact that when I go to the doctor every year, my doctor asks me, you know, are you having sexual relations with your wife? And I say yes. And then the second question she asks me right after that is like, if you're having sex with anyone else. It's a horribly intrusive question. And that's what makes her a great physician. Because she's not asking me because she's a voyeur or because she's, you know, some kind of, you know, wants to get all the details, gossip of my life. She knows that if you have sex with more than one individual, you're at increased risk for sexually transmitted infections, and she wants to be able to counsel me appropriately. That's what makes her a good doctor. We ask about sensitive things, your drug use, your alcohol use, what you eat, what you do. That's what doctors do. And it is dangerous to start this idea that, you know, we're going to now, like, make it illegal for doctors to ask sensitive questions. I don't understand how it is anything but the government getting in between you and your doctor's relationship. If you don't like the question, don't answer it. Or lie. Nothing stops anyone from lying. Or don't go to the doctor. I mean, if you don't want to answer sensitive questions, if you don't want to talk about yourself, don't go to the doctor. But lying about, you know, having a gun in the home is the same as lying about anything else with your child. It's just so that they can provide, you know, adequate preventive guidance. And it's not, you know, nothing of what I wrote or nothing was law was about, like, we want to make new regulations or we want to take your guns away from you or we want to. It's about gun safety in your children and just talking about the facts, and then you go on your way.
I went to the doctor. I had a physical recently, and I was surprised to hear her ask me that question about extramarital relationships. She's like, are you having sex with? And I'd not met this doctor, and my wife, you know, suggested I use her, so my wife's already seen her, just a, you know, general internist. And she said, are you having, you know, sex outside your marriage? And I was like, that's weird. No. And then, but then was it weird that I then looked at her because she's kind of attractive, very attractive. And I said, but I'd like to. Was that,
that
inappropriate?
It's very inappropriate. And they should pass a law banning you from doing that.
All right. I mean, I don't know.
No.
Ended up having sex with her right there in her office, which is a weird kind of porn plot. But what can you do when you're me?
Okay.
Let's talk about Medicare and the trust fund. There's some news about Medicare's financial outlook, and what is that news? What did we learn? What were we told? Certainly, what do we hear? A lot of questions and talk about what Affordable Care Act would do to Medicare, and what have we learned recently?
Well, the slowdown in spending has been so drastic and pervasive that, like, every report that comes out just basically keeps increasing the length of time until the trust fund is out of money. I mean, you kept hearing forever how, like, you know, in 3 years it was going to be gone, and now I think it's going to, like, 2030. And even then we can debate what that actually means. But there's been a slowdown in healthcare spending. No one is really sure why. You will hear people who love the Affordable Care Act, you know, give it credit. You'll hear people that hate the Affordable Care Act say that there's no possible way that they can take credit. It is true that healthcare spending has been slowing down internationally, like worldwide, which would make it seem that this is something else. But that's good news. I mean, for most people, it's like the idea that the trust fund is going, you know, that healthcare spending is less and growing more slowly than it used to be is good in the sense that it makes our budget and our fiscal outlook look much better. And the latest report was, you know, good news in that respect. The spending is slowing. The trust fund is going to last longer. We need to figure out why and do all we can to make this stay and keep working on it. But it is shockingly good news.
Let's quickly go to Bill in St. Louis for Dr. Aaron Carroll. We got to wrap it up here because we're getting the former governor of Ohio. So we're cutting the good doctor short here on a Wednesday. But let's get to one call. Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, Pete. Hey, Dr. Carroll. I always listen to your show. Thank you very much. I have one point, I guess. Is I'm confused. If a doctor is not allowed to say, do you own a gun, couldn't they simply say, if you own a gun, keep it locked up, don't store ammunition, where it's not actually asking the question, just more of information sharing? And
that seems like a waste of time, though, because
people don't understand
when,
like,
you're filling out, when you're filling out, let me take this. I'm a brilliant man. When you're filling out, like, the clipboard when you walk in, it asks you if you've ever had this illness or that illness, what you're allergic to, any surgeries, and you don't, you check off the ones you have. You're saving everybody time. It'd be a weird question. You'd have to ask that question of everything, right? Or you'd have to, right?
So the problem with screening is that if you look at the pediatric guidelines, Bright Futures is hundreds of pages long, the stuff you're supposed to get through. So lots of times you just have questions on checkboards that people can check off so you can identify quickly the things that you need to talk about with this patient. And it's, you know, if I have to submit every person that walks through the door to a 3-minute spiel about, you know, gun safety and how to store bullets in the house and you know, maybe a trigger lock or that is, that's, you know, for the, all the people that don't own guns, I'm now wasting time that I could be spending on other topics that are higher. Doctors aren't stupid. You know, they're prioritizing. And so, you know, they're trying to figure out what are the big risks or the big things that I need to talk about with this patient. And they're not doing every single patient, every single thing exactly the same way. So that, it's, I don't understand why, in other words, should I subject every single person that comes to the door to a lecture on alcohol and drugs? Or should I focus perhaps on the ones that are telling me that they do use drugs? Should I tell every patient about a diet, or should I focus on the ones who are actually obese? At some point, you have to own that doctors ask sensitive questions. If you don't want to ever answer a sensitive question, it's hard to go to the doctor. We ask about very, very personal things, including are you having sex with people outside of your marriage? If I assumed everybody was and then submitted everyone to a talk about, you know, how to minimize the sexual risk, that would be a waste of everybody's time.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the paranoid concern is that for these gun owners that then I guess the doctor's going to turn you in and say,
well, here's the thing, then lie. Okay. I don't understand. Don't answer the question. Say, I'd rather not talk about that. Or just say, no, I don't own a gun. Who cares? Why is it that you're so worried about being asked the question? In other words, if you were having an extramarital affair and you don't want your doctor to know, say you're not. I don't endorse that. I don't think that that's the best way to get health care, but you can do it. That's what everybody's done for years. If you don't want to talk about your drug use because you think it's illegal, don't answer the question.
I'm glad they don't ever ask, do you own grenades? Because I'd be in trouble. And before people start judging me, I'm a terrible fisherman.
Yeah. I mean, I just think that the first step should be, if you're not comfortable answering the question, don't answer the question, rather than try to gag and prevent doctors from talking about this issue with anyone.
We are out of time. As always, thank you very much, sir, for your time today. Thank him on Twitter and follow him at Aaron E. Carroll. If you're not, you're really missing out. Read him at the New York Times and then share those videos. Watch those videos, Healthcare Triage. You learn so much, and get the books. Thank you very much, sir. Appreciate the time.